Welcome to the Current Federal Tax Developments for February the 17th, 2020. Current Federal Tax Developments is brought to you by Kaplan Professional Education and by your State Society of CPAs. I'm Ed Zollers, coming to you from Phoenix, and we're going to talk this week about three specific developments in the week, a little bit shorter list than we normally have. And this week, we're going to actually talk about one that is just an IRS announcement that kind of reminds practitioners what they should be doing in terms of securing data. We'll also talk about the IRS got themselves deeply involved in a long conversation about virtual currencies this week, which finally solved itself, and it got rid of a problem that some people had noticed about prior IRS guidance that may have had lots of Fortnite players having to check Schedule 1's box that yes, they were involved with virtual currencies. And finally, we'll talk about a taxpayer's unsuccessful attempt to challenge the wording of a regulation when the taxpayer didn't follow the regulation in attempting to claim a rather large, about $8 million charitable contribution, and a problem that we ran into because of that. So we got a few things happening this week. So let's go ahead and take a look first at the issue that came down this week from the IRS. This comes from the IRS's news release on their website. The page is entitled IRS Urges Tax Professionals and Taxpayers to Protect Tax Software Accounts with Multi-Factor Authentication. And this is one of those things that came from the IRS's Security Summit presentations or their group. And this is something they are strongly suggesting. Many of you may have already run into this with your tax software. You know, tax software may not be allowing you to do things like file returns electronically or be the person to authorize releasing returns electronically if filed, unless you have enabled multi-factor authentication to prove your account. So let's talk about why the IRS is talking about this, some problems with the way the IRS itself implements the issue, but then talk about maybe what you can do to look at this. And this was a topic that actually was a topic of a course, well, part of a topic of a course I did back in January in Phoenix, where we talked about various security things that a CPA could do to try to make their offices and make their data more secure. And we had a long discussion about the fact that enabling multi-factor authentication probably has the largest bang for the buck in terms of something you can implement which will do the most to protect data. One problem we run into when we talk about doing data protection, we talk about all these courses, and I have, and I like them, you know, it's kind of interesting running on those. But you can easily come out of an IT security course deciding there is so many things, there are so many things you have to do that you just look at the stack, you figure it would cost X dollars more than, you know, you make in the year off of all your clients, and you just decide to give up and do nothing. Now, the problem is understanding that there are multiple threats, that you'll never get rid of all of them, but the question becomes, what's the biggest threat? You know, just because it's possible somebody could break into your house, you know, doesn't mean that you just go ahead and give up and leave doors open, everything unlocked, and say, hey, come on in and take everything. We take steps because there are certain steps that will make it more difficult. And, you know, conceptually, this is one of those steps that makes it more difficult to take over your account. Because the risk of account takeover remains a major problem. In fact, the IRS already noted this, that, you know, they've already seen people having their accounts attempted to be taken over this year. We've had in essence, a number of scams that go off, and tax professionals are subject to attack. I think most everybody listening to this has probably gotten this year at least one scam email offering you a new client who's sending along this package or this link that you should go to where, you know, they will give you all this data. Now, we're all pretty clear by now that that email is really meant to put malware on your machine, which could be a keylogger, other issues, to get the data. They realize the data you have, it's directed at you. We're going to talk here, though, about a little bit different issue, and that is the issue of an account takeover. Account takeovers, we have seen things happen this way, and the problem becomes that usually, and this is what the IRS even tells us, that the attacker, you know, may very well send you an email. The email will appear to come from, it could be a client, it could be a you know, your cloud storage provider, your backup provider. It could be your tax software provider. It could be claiming to come from the IRS. By the way, it's not coming from any of those, but that's first key. A lot of people do not understand. It is trivial to forge the from address in an email. It's trivial to make an email look like it came from the IRS or whoever, or Thomson Reuters or Wolters Kluwer or Intuit. It's trivial, not difficult at all. This is very, very simple. So, but what they'll do, as noted, the IRS tells us, is, and this is also pretty much a deal, this email has something that you need to take action right now. Right? We need action right now. Perhaps, of course, the new big client who is considering firms right now, they need to make a decision by Friday, so you need to download this now and look at it. It could be your software provider or the IRS threatening that they're going to shut off your account. The software provider will not accept e-files from you anymore, or they'll cancel your account entirely. This is probably a bigger issue now that we're seeing more and more tax software providers go to cloud-based systems. So, by the way, in theory, it's plausible that if you're on Access, let's say for CCH, that in theory, CCH could shut down your entire operation tomorrow morning. Right, by denying you entry into the system. With Thomson Reuters hosted systems, same thing. Intuit has a similar structure for some of their products. So that also becomes plausible. The IRS threatening to shut down your e-filing, even if you're not using a cloud-based system, you certainly are using the IRS's system. And so these things panic you into doing something. That's kind of the background. And so the risk becomes of takeover. Now, how the takeover occurs, basically, three ways we have problems and why passwords and usernames are not a good idea, right? Let's talk about the problems we've got here. First thing is you may just simply choose a poor password. Password, not a good password. Even if you change the O to a zero, that's also not a good password. That'll be guessed by anybody trying to brute force their way in. So the first issue is somebody could just get into whatever account you've got by guessing your password. This probably, though, to be totally honest, unless you actually use password, may not be as big a problem because most services will stop you after three guesses. And unless you're using a really, really bad password or one that's obvious, three guesses, it'll be more intensive. So I'm not saying you should have a bad password, but I am saying of the risk levels, this is probably the lowest of the three. Nevertheless, don't have bad passwords. Really big. Because it's the lowest risk level doesn't mean it's not a dumb thing to do, because it's trivial to fix it if you actually get good passwords. By the way, yes, use a password manager. I know what you're going to tell me. It's a single point of failure. I understand that. But the alternatives are a real problem, because the second way that they're going to get access to your account is one that actually is very effective and will be tried. That is, because you have to have you need passwords for every site. You probably have a password for, your tax software provider. You have a password for your research service. You have a password that gets you into your backup service. You may have a password if you have cloud storage for the cloud storage system. You probably have a password that you have to use to get into maybe your banking. You have a password that you need for because, your family has forced you to Facebook. You have another password for LinkedIn. You have passwords for all these things. And it's like, yeah, I don't want it. So I'm just going to use one password for every one of them. That's a problem, because if there is a leakage of the password, why could there be a leakage? Because one of those databases is not stored very securely. They're storing the password in plain text, which they shouldn't do. And that gets breached. A third party gets access to that password. And by the way, a number of years ago, that happened to LinkedIn. If you've not changed your LinkedIn password in the last decade, there's a problem. If you're using the password that you used on LinkedIn the last decade, yes, you may have changed LinkedIn's password because they told you to, but you never went and changed anywhere else. Yeah, people are still getting burned by that LinkedIn password, that they're losing controls of accounts because they use the same password on LinkedIn as somewhere else. The LinkedIn breach happened. They may have changed their LinkedIn password, but they never went back and changed the password for their tax software. And yeah, that's probably a bigger problem. So yes, they try that. Password managers eliminate the incentive or eliminate the risk that you're going to be using the same password everywhere, or that your staff will, and that's going to cause it to be an easy, simple breach. But the third option is, the other way they'll get it, is the phishing. That's that email that says, log into the IRS website right now because we're going to cancel your electronic filing options. Right? You go there, you get a login. The login looks perfectly normal. Looks exactly like how you'd get in. So you give your username, your password. They give you some sort of error message, or they just send you to the IRS website and log in for you, which they could easily do. Right? They could make it look good. depending on what you do. So you get the login, they get all that information. They get that for your tax software provider, they get that for your bank, they get you that for your cloud provider. And the problem is, if all you have is username, password, and that is what the vast majority of people will do, even if they're offered the option of multi-factor, if they can use username, password, they will. That means once they've done that, they now have access to the account in full. Multi-factor authentication says you need something else besides username, password. Generally, true multi-factor authentication says you have to provide at least two factors to get into the account, two different factors from two different classes. The classes are something you know, that would be your username, password, something you have, maybe it's a physical hardware key, maybe it's a token, maybe it's your phone that has an app running at it, on it, and you need access to that app, therefore to the phone, to get a code you're going to enter back in. Maybe it is a fingerprint or an iris scan, you know, something you are, right? So combination of two things, something you know, something you have, something you are, two of those three required to get in. The idea being, if something you know is breached, the secret is breached, they still won't have the token they're supposed to have to get in, or they won't have your fingerprint, they won't have your iris. So the idea is we can keep them from getting the account. This is proven insanely good at stopping access. In fact, I referenced in the materials this week, you can download, we referenced a study that was published in May of last year that was involved Google, and it was New York University and University of California San Diego study that looked at the effectiveness and multi-factor authentication. Now, we'll talk about that study again as to what's the best type, but multi-factor authentication proved to be insanely better than anything else at stopping account takeovers. And that's important because Google has been using the high-level version, which we'll talk about here in a second, internally for the last few years. And reality is they've had no account takeovers from their employee accounts. And that's very good batting average, especially for something you realize that the kind of data they're sitting on, that there are a lot of parties that have been trying to somehow finagle their way in by getting an account takeover there. So, interesting aside to look at. We'll talk about that. So, the idea is, MFA, multi-factor authentication, is going to do it. Now, the ways we tend to do it, there are really some options today. One option may be you'll get an SMS message on your phone, right? So when you go to log into the website will say, okay, we just sent a text message to your phone with 6 digits. Please give us those digits back. You give those digits back. The idea being that the text message went to your phone. You have the phone. You did the password. You then have the phone. The phone is something else. You put the code in that went to the phone. That proves, we'll get to whether it really does prove, but it proves you had the phone. And therefore, it helps to prove you're you because somebody with just a username password wouldn't have access to your phone, probably. We'll get into the problems with SMS messaging here in just a second. Other way you might do it is an authenticator app. This is when you go and you set up multi-factor authentication. You'd be presented most often with a QR code on the screen. That's that, you know, kind of odd, not really a barcode, but the same sort of concept. And your phone takes a camera of it. If you have an authenticator app, they ask you to basically take a picture of that. You know, have those cameras see it. It sees it. That creates a shared secret between you and the website. And that is used along with the current date and time as you're logging in to generate a 6-digit code. Only the other side, the server out there in the real world, and your phone know this secret, right? Nothing's transmitted when you do it, but when you go to log in, you're asked to give the 6-digit code. The best known authenticator is Google Authenticator because that was like the first one that became popular, but the standard used in Google Authenticator is supported by a ton of other authenticators. So there are various options you're using. If you take a look at Thomson Reuters product, if you're using their stuff, their authenticator is basically based on the Google Authenticator system. Same basic backup. You can actually use Google Authenticator for Thomson Reuters. If you don't want to use their app, you can do the code. So it's actually the same basic structure. Sometimes the vendors will have a specific app that they will hopefully securely communicate with that you'll install on your phone. Thomson Reuters does this. Some others do it. Microsoft does it. They'll do a secure communication back to your phone. So when somebody tries to log in, you'll get a message saying, attempted login. Are you want to approve this? You say yes or no on your phone. Again, you prove you had your phone. Little concern there, because unless you know for sure they programmed it right, there's always concern they might have done something really stupid, like transmitted that in the clear, which would be a really bad idea. So hopefully they're not doing anything stupid. And you have to kind of hope they aren't when you use their app. The authenticators, that one we know pretty much how they work. Finally, you may get a hardware key. This is using something, the one I talked about when I do the course was a YubiKey. There are other options, Google's Titan keys. There are other products that make these, but this is a hardware token that when you go to log in, you insert this into the USB port on your computer, you press a button. So I've got my username, password. Now on the computer I'm trying to use, I have to present the key to show I'm there. In essence, that's a physical key. That's probably the highest level of security, because you got to have the key. And it's even resistant to what's called replay attacks for the most part, because a replay attack would be where somebody might be sitting out there with a fake website and logging in to the real one at the same time, got your username, password, then they're going to get the two-factor thing to come to you. In the hardware token, the problem with that is they don't have the token on that machine, and the token has to be presented on the machine actually being logging in. So they can't get the token information, they can't get the physical token on their machine. So that's the highest level. Now, Google has pointed out that, yes, there's a little question. The hardware key is the way they worked. It also is the one in the study that clearly stopped account takeovers that were attempted. In essence, they took a look at cases where somebody had pilfered the username password. The question was, and it got past whatever internal controls they had, did the account get taken over? And as they said, when we have these keys, it essentially stopped it in all cases. Now, SMS, why is that a problem? Well, the problem is the messaging system, text messaging, SMS is just text messaging on your phone. The text messaging system was never designed to be secure. It's not really secure. There are some issues with how things transmit over the network. But more importantly, that's totally tied to whoever has that phone number at the moment. Now, you might think, wait, I've got that phone number, I have the phone. But that phone number basically is tied to your phone these days by the SIM card in the phone. And if a third party in a targeted attack wanted to take over your account, right, what they could do is, if they know your phone number, right, and they know who the carrier is for that number, which is pretty easy to find out if they're going to do some digging, they could go into, let's say, the store, right, the carrier store, and give this, story about, I lost my phone. This is the second time I've done it. I don't want to tell my spouse because my spouse is going to kill me for losing it. I just need to set up this phone. Can you set me up on the code? And, I don't know the PIN. I can't remember those things. I'm going to be in so much trouble. Get the SIM set up. When that SIM goes in another phone, your phone's going to stop receiving the text messages and the calls. All the text messages and calls will go to the phone that SIM just got put in and got activated on. If they do that and they already have your username password, they can take over the account. Now, that means dedicated, so the good news is it's not going to be easy to do. But the bad news is, if somebody really wants in, they certainly could do a lot of damage in the few hours they probably have to do this before you realize your phone's not working. And you decide, I better call Verizon or T-Mobile or AT&T or whoever and figure out what's up. That, they have some time there before you figure out what's happened. So, and they can do a lot of damage in that time frame. So that's the catch. The IRS describes the issue in theirs. They do talk about providing that because they internally only use SMS. That's the only example they give. But the other options are there. My takeaway is how you do it. If you have the option for all of your accounts that have any client data, check to see if they offer multi-factor. If they offer multi-factor, turn it on. If you have options, the best one is to get the key, like a YubiKey or a Google Titan key, and use that as your method. Now, if you do that, be sure to get two keys, because if you lose one, you're really locked out. You know, we're going to talk about recovery here in just a second. If you don't have that option, take a look to see the authenticators, right? The app-based authenticators. Your choice, if you trust the vendor enough, which is kind of iffy, maybe you don't, but you could use the vendor's own system that prompts you, or you could use the numeric authenticators. I'm going to lean a little bit toward the numeric because we understand how that works, and unfortunately, badly designed apps are known to happen where somebody just didn't even think, oh, nobody would ever look to catch that. It's like it's a security app. Hopefully you thought about that, but I'm not going to say nobody will ever foul up in doing one of those. So, you know, your mileage may vary, but again, you can use that. If you don't have that those options, then SMS is better than nothing. And that study I told you about with Google, what Google found was if there was a truly targeted attack where they wanted your account, even SMS blocked about 3/4 of those attempts to take over an account. So if you had SMS-based multi-factor authentication, even if you had somebody targeting you, I mean, the odds are, as a CPA firm, they're going to move on to the next victim rather than try to fight and get your phone number, right? Now, to give you the difference, the hardware key blocked essentially 99%, or basically all, virtually all, statistically virtually all, of the attacks. In fact, I don't think that any they've done, but they're not going to say it's going to block 100%. There still are ways you could get around it, theoretically. They also found that the authenticator apps blocked 96% of attacks. There are reasons why they wouldn't, including if you have your, you know, if you have that shared secret backed up and somebody got control of that. Yeah, there are reasons why that could fail, depending on how you lock it down, but it's still pretty good. So definitely IRS suggests you need to turn these things on. And a big reason you want to now is with this out there and the IRS telling us we're supposed to be using this, if you suffer a breach, you may face regulatory sanctions or you may face liability in courts, because what they'll say is you had a duty to protect data. This data got out because accounts were taken over. These takeovers wouldn't have happened except you didn't use two-factor authentication. And because of that, yeah, now you're liable. Now, I realize you're going to get pushback if you try to make everybody use it. They're going to say it's inconvenient. What if I forget my phone? What if I, you know, what if this happens? It's like, yeah, security by definition is inconvenient. But if you allow anybody to opt out, by the way, it does include the owners. I hate to tell you this, guys. The fact that you may own the CPA firm, you may be a shareholder, you may be a partner, does not make you immune. In fact, you're probably the main target. You need to back that stuff up. I mean, you need to really have this system in place. And as I said, with the IRS recommendation, it's really risky not to follow. Next up, this was the fun part this week. The IRS got off on virtual currencies. Now, you may remember Schedule 1 added that question this year, asking, at any time during 2019, did you receive, sell, send, exchange, or otherwise acquire any financial interest in a virtual currency? Well, of course, one question is, what exactly does the IRS mean by virtual currency? There was a pre-existing IRS web page that talked about virtual currencies. You know, in fact, we've got the link to it in the materials, and we have a link to both in the from the Wayback Machine, the version that existed before the 12th of February, and also the link to the current version. Now, the version that existed before the 12th of February said the following. Virtual currency, that has equivalent value in real currency or that acts as substitute for real currency is referred to as convertible virtual currency. Now, step just back for a second. Obviously, to be convertible virtual currency, it has to be virtual currency. And then they give examples of that. And they say Bitcoin, okay, good. Ether, okay, fine. Roblox and V-Bucks are a few examples of a convertible virtual currency. Now, for those of you who aren't aware, Roblox is an online game, and V-Bucks is the currency used in the Fortnite game, extremely popular game. And the problem became, does that mean that if you bought V-Bucks for your kid to use in Fortnite, that you need to start checking the box and saying yes, and will all these returns come in with yeses because all these people have kids or even themselves playing these games? Well, the IRS this week began to get questions. Apparently, and it appears that a reporter for BNA Tax contacted the IRS and wanted to ask about this. You know, really, you want this on Schedule 1? And her call was never returned, right? In fact, what happened is Allie Versbro was the one who ran it down, and her call was never returned, but she noticed the website suddenly changed. And now the website simply says that, you know, Bitcoin is one example of a convertible virtual currency. It eliminated the other three. And that was interesting because we got rid of it. They didn't answer the question, but they got rid of it. Okay? And so, you know, tried to follow up, got no follow-up. The next day, the IRS chief counsel was speaking. The reporters cornered the chief counsel, asked him about essentially what's going on here. And he said, oh, well, you know, the website was wrong, it was corrected, don't worry about that. So he asked, okay, specific question. So if people have gaming currency and don't need to check yes on the 1040. And in response to that question, he then backed off and said, I'm not even looking into that. I'm not saying one way or the other. I think I'd be getting ahead of myself if I said anything. Read the website. We posted a correction, which didn't exactly calm things down. Finally, on Valentine's Day, the IRS posted or gave the press a further update. Stating, in this case, the IRS recognizes that the language on our page potentially caused concern for some taxpayer. We have changed the language in order to lessen any confusion. Transacting in virtual currencies as part of a game that do not later leave the game environment, virtual currencies that are not convertible, would not require a taxpayer to indicate this on their tax return. Okay, that last sentence. Now, there's been quibbling about that last sentence and what's really meant, and I'm not going to go too far. I'm going to tell you, basically it means, I think the best way to interpret that is, as long as the currency stays in game, you buy your kid V-Bucks, the V-Bucks are used by your child to purchase whatever they're purchasing in Fortnite, that's not a reportable transaction. But if you were if you were selling an illegal substance and you received payment in V-Bucks from somebody, and you then went out and you sold those V-Bucks, first thing is you'd have revenue, you know, from the sale of the product, from having received the V-Bucks for it. And then secondly, you'd have a capital gain or loss on the sale of the V-Bucks. And bottom line, you would check the box yes. But if they're just using it in-game, it's not a problem. I think the IRS hopes this is the last word we're going to have on this. I suspect it is. I was never terribly worried about the currencies, but it was kind of weird. It was on the website. It's gone now. So for all that's worth, if your clients were concerned about that, or if they've read about it because it hit the mainstream media this week too, it was not just on the tax sites by the time this finished. Number of mainstream sites also picked up the story. So your clients may ask you about it. Now you got some clue what it is. Finally, this week, let's take a look at the one case we have this week, Oak Hill Woods LLC versus Commissioner. Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2020-24, issued on February 13th. This is a case of a taxpayer who granted a conservation easement to a charity, right, and was attempting to claim nearly an $8 million contribution as a qualified charitable easement. Now, as you know, if you try to claim a contribution for property in excess of $5,000, and this is a little bit in excess of $5,000, the regulations tell you that you have to submit a qualified appraisal, right? In fact, only the regulations do. IRC Section 170 F11C provides specifically, in the case of property, contribution to property for which a deduction of more than $5,000 is claimed, the requirements of subparagraph are met if the individual, partnership, or corporation obtains a qualified appraisal of such property and attaches to the return for the taxable year in which contribution is made such information regarding such property and such appraisal as the secretary may require. Well, in this case, they did not include, which is required in the regulations, that you attach, that part of that summary of the contribution attached to the return is going to be a showing of your basis. You need to say when I acquired the property, how I acquired it, and what my basis is. They did not attach the basis. And they actually intentionally missed it. They said the declaration of taxpayer's basis in property is not included in the attached Form 8283 because of the fact the basis of the property is not taken into consideration when computing the amount of the deduction. Furthermore, the taxpayer has a holding period in the property in excess of 12 months, and the property further qualifies as capital gain property. Okay, Not only did they not put it on, they were intentionally not putting it on, right? And that created an issue. Now, when the IRS came in and challenged this, the taxpayer tried to say, well, I didn't know that was there, and you know, I was relying on my CPA, and it was relying on the appraiser and the charity to do it right. And he said, you know, and basically I substantially complied with the requirements. So even though it didn't have that, it had everything else the IRS needed, and you know, I gave him the basis on exam, so you know, it really shouldn't be thrown out based on this. Well, the problem was that after the time they submitted their case to the tax court, and before they came up for trial, the tax court had decided in the Beller Woods case, Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2018-159, and a virtually identical situation, that the failure to provide cost basis was a significant departure from what was required in the regulations. It was required, so you couldn't have a qualified appraisal without it, and you could not have substantial compliance. Substantial compliance is, even if I didn't quite do the reg, I basically did everything and it was just a minor detail that I didn't do right. They said this isn't a minor detail. Taxpayer are now aware that since Beller Woods has been decided on their facts, and they got basically the same facts, that they're probably going down the same path, which, by the way, they did in this case. Same problem, said not minor, not disallowed. They said, well, we're going to try a second act. We're going to claim the reg is invalid. So they argued the regulation was invalid, and what they said was it didn't reflect the language of the statute. And in an uncodified section of DEFRA, which was the Deficit Restoration Act of 1984, which added this provision, they had various, you know, part of the law says when they're doing this, right, they advanced Congress's objectives. They said, in essence, the taxpayer claims certain items, and one of the things they said specifically in that section was to include on such returns additional information, including the cost basis, acquisition date of the property, as the secretary may prescribe in the regulations. And the taxpayer said, aha, see, it said in the return, and they're saying put it in the, you know, put in the appraisal summary. So they're going against the expressed wishes of Congress that where it had to be was in the return itself, not in this appraisal summary. Tax court didn't go too far down this. Let's talk about how you challenge a reg's validity. Under the current structures, now I know there's discussions whether the Supreme Court will change the Chevron standard or not, but basically under the current standard we have, which the Supreme Court advanced in the Chevron case, there are two questions we want to see if a reg's valid. And this covers not just tax regs, but all regs. First thing is, did Congress speak specifically to the matter in the regulation that we're trying to answer? Did Congress tell us that this cost number had to be in a document other than the attached appraisal and appraisal summary? Okay. The tax court said no. First thing is, they said you got a problem, right? It says, look, a return is not just the form 8283 or whatever other document you're talking about. You know, the return is all documents required to be submitted. The appraisal is part of the return. So they said, even if we say literally that they said it had to be in the return, by requiring you to attach an appraisal to the return, the cost number is in the return, and they told you how to present it. They said, secondly, even if that wasn't the case, the code itself very clearly gives the IRS the authority to specify what has to be attached. They're saying, so it's clear, they gave it to them. There is a, you know, so there existed a question that Congress did not answer. Congress did not say it had to be on a form on the return. They just said it had to be in the return, you know, on the return. And they're saying, look, this required attachment is on the return. But they said, secondly, okay, let's assume that Congress didn't answer it. Because, you know, now you could have put it in this thing. You could have put it on the return. Question is the IRS interpretation a, you know, basically an acceptable interpretation of the law? And what we're really looking for there is the IRS's rule reasonable? And the court found clearly it was. You know, the question of basis versus claim deduction, clearly that's important. Congress was concerned about abusive claims of charitable contributions, people claiming charitable contributions. By the way, similar to what some of the issues we're looking at now on some of these easements, not necessarily this one, but we're looking at the fact where, you know, you buy the property, you're sold this easement package where, oh, give us $10,000 a day, And, next year we will pass out a conservation easement. We're going to go buy the property. But magically, a year and a day from today, even though you only put $10,000 in, your deduction will somehow be $140,000, right, for that easement, for just the portion of the property. That'll be your deduction. They're saying, yeah, that would be good. You know, somebody just paid $10,000 to buy the whole property, and a year and a day later is claiming that granting the easement only is worth $140,000. That probably indicates that this is something the IRS likes to look at. So it seems like valid information. So bottom line, the IRS was held, the Congress had spoken to the issue. The IRS interpretation was permissible. Court held, bottom line, you guys didn't attach this. Now, they did hold out one thing, which is held for trial in this case. The question was, had they reasonably relied upon the CPA and basically the appraiser, there is a chance under reasonable reliance they might be able to get around the problem. But it's going to be interesting to see how the court looks at that. They just said we need more facts to make that choice. It's not impossible, so we're not going to decide that today. We're going to go to trial on that issue and see what evidence is presented. Bottom line, if you're trying to challenge a reg, yeah, it's difficult. Number two, when you're making charitable contributions, especially, Section 170 has requirements for virtually every contribution that have to be met. Make sure that those are being met, that your clients are aware of the requirements, that they can't just say, I threw $5 into a, into a donation bucket. Christmas time, I went by a Salvation Army bell ringer, and I threw $5 in. And I want to claim that $5. Well, you really can't under the law because you don't have a receipt. You don't have a check. Yet you don't have proof, right, of how you did it. And even down to that small contribution now, you need to have at least the check or other document to back up the fact you made the contribution. So you need to make sure of that. Number two, if you're going to challenge a reg, reg challenging is difficult. It succeeds more often than challenging a code section because of constitutionality. But it doesn't really succeed that often. And if you're really going to go down that path, remember, you do an A275R if you do disagree with the reg and claim it's invalid. And number two, my bottom line is the client better be willing to litigate the darn thing. Because I'm going to expect, regardless, the IRS is going to disallow the position. And I've said many times when I've done courses, I consider an A275R to be a much more significant form than A275 for disclosure. So, yeah, have to watch that. Well, we are getting, tax time's coming. We're going to, probably starting Tuesday, all the brokers are supposed to have their first set, at least consolidated 1099 should be out, or they need to get extensions on them. So we'll probably have most everything Tuesday. We'll have at least the first set before the amended ones start showing up. But remember, start watching your state society's catalogs, especially when we get to the end of tax season, to start signing up for CPE next year. Some point probably during tax season, we'll get the 163J regulations. And I'm sure you're going to need to get up to speed on those. So keep an eye on that. Keep an eye on other stuff coming up. Keep an eye. I've already got dates booked. We're not going to say anything about those dates until the state societies in question actually release their catalogs. But I'm already looking at coming around a few courses this year and looking forward to moving around the country some. So we'll see what's coming up. Once they're out, I'll try to let you know that we're starting to see some of these state society courses come out. This has been the Current Federal Tax Developments for this week. You can catch my regular updates online, currentfulltaxdevelopments.com on the website. I also, post regularly on Twitter, so you can follow me on @EdZollers. If you have any questions or comments, send them to me, email edzollers@currentfulltaxdevelopments.com. I do follow discussions on the subreddit /r/taxpros and also on the websites run by the Arizona Society, the Minnesota Society, New Jersey Society, their Connect sites, as well as follow along somewhat on CalCPIA's Tax Talk. So if you post some questions there, I may jump in there if I think I can help with the answers. They're also very good resources otherwise for finding out information, so you may want to check there. Well, like I say, we're here. It's a short week for everybody, probably except those of us who are actually down there having to do tax returns. We're all probably working on President's Day, but hey, the mail won't run, and it also means that the brokerage statements are going to come out till the next day. We'll get that going. But for this short week, it also means we probably won't have as many developments this week as normal because, again, we won't have any tax court cases on Monday. The IRS won't be releasing stuff on Monday, so we'll see what comes out. But join us next week. We'll talk about whatever does come out here on Current Federal Tax Developments.